no more. Yo, I begin to burn, begin to rumble when I blabber. Great, I begin to make the wonder twins, the actor fake. It's crazy. I'm begin to breaking backs and busting lips. I begin to freak, glad the snipe and those freaking pips. Shrimps, I begin to make enough noise like Bam Bam. Throw boulders from bedrock, you'll get dropped by Slam Man, so check it. I begin to wreck it quick, oh shucks. I give it to got big ducks like Daddy War Bucks. Oh Anna, I begin to rock the Coca Cabana. Banana, split, hot, hook, spit, so sick. I begin to freak it from here to Bangladesh. I'm ripping the ripping flesh, but I get fresh like this. Shish, shiggy the shush, kid, you'll get done. For fun, I riggedy rhyme like no one. I riggedy bump, riggedy rust, chickity jumps, I'm savage. I shake them up and down like the Dow Jones average. I'm cocky like Rocky, I riggedy bangs the best. So diggity tell your friend chump, cause here comes that's a vex.
Yeah, microphone, check.
This episode of Mike Chick is very special to me, man. I had my friend, comrade, fellow college graduate at Saint University with me, Iowa State University. Shout out to my Cyclones all out there that listen. Curtis Jeff Tarver II, man. This brother, man, I can't say so many different things, accolades about this brother, man. He is a role model, man, not only for children and people who are younger, but for other males that are grinding out there and doing their thing, black male, and not even for black males, period, for males, period, or any men, period, in this world. This brother's doing it. He's really, really doing it, and he's humble. He's, you know, a spiritual brother. He's all those different things that you would look up to and be like, man, that's the type of man I want to be. This brother went from working as a lawyer in the city of Chicago, for Mayor Daley during his time there, all the way to owning his own law firm that's successful now, to also becoming one of the only and the first, actually the first black owned brewery in the state of Illinois, and one of only seven owned black owned breweries in the country. I mean, that's a hell of a story, hell of a journey this brother's been on, coming from the south side of Chicago all the way to own his own brewery and his own law firm. It was a story I forgot to tell on this episode. I'm going to tell it now, just a little bit about how me and him were in college together. Met this brother, man. We were all revolutionary type brothers, being at Iowa State University, trying to affect change, trying to, you know, affirm some aspect of our blackness within a campus that was majority white. But also learning and learning how to deal and learning how to navigate and be a part of the what we want to describe as is the American dream, per se. I was actually fired from the Iowa State Daily as a writer. I was a columnist there. As far as I know, I think I was the first black weekly columnist there. I can research and find out, a weekly columnist that was there. I wrote a piece on. And it's interesting, this is all full circle when even talking about this, but there was a young lady at I forgot what university it was in New York, like a D2 school. And this is around the time of us going to Iraq and all that war back in 2002, 2003 time. And she turned her back on the flag during the national anthem with the flag. And I wrote a whole piece defending her right to be able to do that. And it was kind of, maybe it was a little bit more incendiary than it needed to be. And I really fought, and they wanted me to produce the, to do another piece. It was towards the end of me getting ready to being at Iowa State. I was getting ready to graduate, and I was like, no. Well, they were like, well, your services won't be needed here anymore. And I get it from their point though. So at that time, you know, I was already writing some kind of things that were going crazy, at the school in general. And I was that kind of, you know, weekly columnist that was trying to hit those different types of issues. But I remember, we had a movement that me, him, a lot of sisters and brothers at this started called Got Ignorance. It was basically a rally and a mantra that we pushed across campus and had an event where we basically wanted to pull people together and stop ignorant thought processes on, you know, racism, sexism, people that were, you know, certain sex, certain homosexuality, all the different stuff. We want to bring all those people together. And so like, yo, we are all together. We're trying to be, make this country better, make this campus a better place. So I had to, I called him. I remember I was like, man, you know, they let me go. They want me to do my piece. So he I was like, I'm gonna do it myself and reproduce it. So back in that time, this is for some of our listeners that, you know, probably are, this is going to get a little bit older for y'all. But basically, at that time, being a part of school of journalism at Iowa State, you had a certain amount of piece of paper that you could print off that were free, that you just print anything for free being a part of that school. So I said, you know what? I had a whole bunch. I think I had maybe like 2,000 or 3,000 pages I could print. I never really printed much off through the school there besides papers or anything like that. So I was like, I'm going to produce the paper myself through the Iowa State Daily and through journalism school and push, produce it and make it as an insert inside of as many Iowa State dailies as I can during the last couple of weeks of school. So he's like, yeah, I'm down. I want to write it. So me and him went through this process of writing it. Now, my article is maybe only a page and a half. Jeff decides to give me a dissertation on criminality and the idea of blackness being in America, and it was dope. But and it was so funny, we were inserting them across campus and putting them inside all the Iowa State dailies, and it got out and it was a big old hoorah and everything. But that brother had my back, and he was always someone that kept his morality and his idea of what he thought was right in the forefront. So yeah, I hope you all really enjoyed this episode of Mike Checker. Make sure you hit us up, you know, with all your thoughts, questions, comments, all those good things, straightolc@gmail.com, and subscribe to us, Stroud Lowcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, all those different things. And I hope you all really enjoy this, and yeah, keep it going. Peace.
Sip the juice, I got enough to go around. And the thought takes place uptown. I grew up on a sidewalk while on street talk, and then taught to hawk New York. I go to Queens for Queens to get the food from Brooklyn. Make money in Manhattan and never been took it. Go uptown to the Bronx and boogie down. Get strong on the island, recoup and lay around. Time to build my juice back up. Pop stack up, suckers get smacked up. Don't doubt the clout, you know what I'm about. Knocking niggas off, knocking niggas out. Shaking them up, waking them up. Breaking them up, breaking them up. Standing on shaky ground, too close to the edge. Let's see if I know the ledge. Corners trifling, shorties here. I get cocked in living 40s to beer. Here's a sip for the
man, thank you for coming on, though, my dude. I'm proud of you. Probably make, I don't know if I'm proud of you more than your mom's is, but I'm right up in there, man. Like, you know, just to see where we came from, man. The trajectory, man. This, I mean, all us cats, man, coming up, man. I tell people all the time, man. I remember I'm actually interviewing I Say, man, later on this week, man. But I remember I don't even remember that conversation. We told us that we were smarter than cats in Ivy League. You remember that when he was telling us in his office?
Yeah.
And he was like, dude.
Yeah, I mean, we believed him.
No, we didn't until we like, come on, man. We're at Iowa State, man. We're a Big 12 school. Come, but then he broke it down like, all you got to do is get into an Ivy League school. They ain't gonna give you no lower than a C.
Sure.
And he was like, you know, you ain't gonna get this education as much because they ain't gonna give you no lower C because they want their grades to be inflated, saying all our students keep a 3.3 GPA at Harvard or at Stanford and Yale and things like that. And he was like, dude, y'all cats are just as smart as them, man. But, like, to see everybody I know, man, you know, even some of the cats that went kind of wayward, you know, over the years, you know, it just is a part of the story, man. But let's go and start, you know, tell a little bit, you know, the story. Like, you know, I know you, did you grow up in Hillcrest or did you live somewhere else before you moved out to Hillcrest down south in Chicago?
So we were born in Chicago, and my parents ended up buying a house out south. Then shortly after that, you know, they ended up divorcing. And so we had never gone to school outside. We always went to school in the city because we were pretty much my grandmother's house every day. So, you know, certain nights out of the week, we would lay our head in Hazelcrest. But for the most part, we were always in the city right off 116th and Ashland.
Okay.
Because our grammar school was, you know, four or five blocks away. So my mom was single, you know, and kind of raising three folks. So it was a lot easier for her just to drop us off in the city. You know, we had to spend a night because she was working 3 to 11s or 11 to 7. She's a nurse. So we just always get our grandmother's house. And it was cool because my grandmother, my uncle lived a block away. So, you know, all his kids over there were in my grandmother's house. And I had another uncle who lived about 5 blocks away. So you had, you know, 10, 12, 15 of us, you know, any given time. Just, you know, and an interesting thing is all of us kind of went different ways as well. Some folks went into the military. You know, my cousin went to prison. Mom went to University of Chicago. So it's just, you know, it's kind of typical story of, you know, folks in the urban environment.
So after there and everything, this is an interesting part of your story where you went to Catholic school at first for high school, and then you you actually skipped the grade at first too. So
I skipped the grade when I was really young. I'm 35. I don't even remember. I skipped the grade very, very early on because I always remember being in class with my sister who's a year older. So I don't really remember being in a separate class from her. So it had to be a really long time ago.
So you're talking about like kindergarten, first grade type stuff then?
Yeah. It was back then. And interestingly enough, at one point, my father told me he came back to him and asked him if I could try to skip again. And they were just like, no.
You know, they were trying to have you all messed up. They were trying to have you all kind of socially messed up.
Yeah, exactly. there's no, I don't care how many things you can memorize as a kid, how many tests you can take. There's no way you can have social skills to be like, you know, a 6-year-old in third grade or something. I mean, there's no way that that works. So yeah, I ended up skipping a grade. We always went to Catholic schools, and then through 10th grade, I was at a Catholic school. And at that point, my parents were like, look, we don't have enough money to keep you here. You ended up having to go to the neighborhood school. And so at that point, I think I was almost either driving or about to be driving. You know, they weren't going to have me driving back and forth to the city to go to school there. So they just, you know, my mom just picked the school around the corner from us. And I'm going to Hillcrest for my last 2 years.
Because where'd you go before? Where'd you go before there?
Me and Kathy.
That's right. That's because you went to school with Jeff.
Yeah.
With the other Jeff.
Yeah, yep. With Jeff Beckham, yep, exactly.
Because y'all were in the same class then, right?
We were in the same class. What's even funnier is when we first moved out south, first of all, my parents sold, my parents were real estate agents at one point, and they sold Jeff's parents their house. That's how we actually initially met. I mean, like a long time ago. Then we ended up at the same grammar school for about a year, and my parents took us back out and put us in the city again. So we had like this 1 year that we went to school in the suburbs, and they were like, nah, put them back in the city. So Jeff and I actually had gone to grammar school, a school called St. Joseph's in Homewood. The really ironic thing about it is that school is about 400 feet from the brewery we're putting in Homewood.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, talking about things to move full circle.
Dang.
Same side of the street, like 400 feet away, is where the expansion, the brewery is on. So, crazy.
Dang. So then after that, you went to Hillcrest, and then... What was there a big difference for you academically and different things from going from Marian Catholic to Hillcrest?
Yeah, man. I mean, when the year I graduated from Hillcrest, I remember seeing the statistics, and it was like out of 100 and, you know, whatever schools, and it wasn't, I don't think it was all of Cook County, but it was certainly a certain section of Cook County. Hillcrest was ranked, you know, if it was 145 schools, they were ranked like 144. It was bad.
And what was it, Thornton? Was Thornton the last one?
I think I'm almost positive Thornton was the last one. I'm almost positive.
No, that wasn't a hard guess either, though, for me to guess that. Like, well, let me see, yeah. Thornton. Yeah, Thornton got to be last.
Yeah. Right. You knew it wasn't HF or anything like that, yeah. So it was definitely different, man, because the one thing about a place like Marion is, when you walk in the door, you know, when they call a school a college prep school, that's what they mean. So, you know, from day one, you have a counselor, somebody kind of as a guidepost to talk to you about college and, you know, those types of things. And at a school like Marion, you always know you're working toward going to college. At a school like Hillcrest, you kind of know that you're working toward getting a diploma. Those are different paths to some extent. I mean, you have to have a diploma to get to college. Fine, we can agree to that. But there was not a lot of pushing folks, unless you were, you know, in the top of the class, to say, you know, think about college. So it was definitely a huge difference. to me between those two. I think a lot of people would figure, well, it's a school in the suburbs, you know, it's paying decent money in property taxes. It has to be good. That's not true.
Yeah. But the Hillcrest was sitting kind of on a border situation, though, wasn't it? Where if you probably, because especially where you at, if you would have been a couple of miles south, you'd have been like an HF or something, right?
Correct. Correct. I mean, what it really boiled down to, there were parts of Hillcrest, I want to say like this area, Dynasty Lakes, like different subdivisions. The best way to put it is as like the newer places popped up where people were spending a real crap load of money on taxes, you know, amazingly, they were zoned somehow into the HF district. And it made sense. Like, you want to track those families and get them out there, you're not going to get somebody at that time to pay, you know, $300,000 for a house or whatever it was, $250,000, I guess, and go to Hillcrest. Like, it just, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't going to make sense. And so, I don't know, I mean, I was a lot younger than them, but I would imagine politically they figured out a way to get people, you know, to draw them in by saying, hey, you can go to this really good school. But it only helped also, like, a few people.
So then you like matriculated through what, like, was there, what influenced you, I guess, younger to be like, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to, you know what I'm saying? Cause you went to UIC at first. What made you say like, you know, I'm going to go to UIC. Who's going to influence you to go here? Why'd you choose that school at first before, you know, any other schools?
So it's funny, man. One of my guys, so you've met, George.
Yeah.
We were real tight. George is, I mean, he was always doing decent. He was good in school. He was, you know, on a golf team, you know, like that type of stuff, whatever. So his path was pretty much set. And I just remember him being like, you going to college? I'm like, yeah, fool. Like, I mean, so in my mind, it was kind of a no-brainer. But then he was like, you take the ACT? And I'm like, what's that? So, it wasn't exactly what's that, but it was one of those things where, like, in Marion, we've been struggling with that stuff from the beginning. And I transferred in. Nobody really, I mean, I came in as a junior. And nobody was asking if, you know, you're taking the ACT if you plan to take it. And so, really, it was George's response, you know, his probe, you know, me, and then he say, like, okay, I got to figure this out. And so, I only applied to a couple of schools. I didn't have a lot of exposure. You know, like, I was a Florida State fan, which, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I didn't know what it was like to apply to an out-of-state school. And there was nobody in my family there who had gone to an out-of-state school that I could think of. I had a cousin who had gone to the University of Chicago. Grew up on the South Side. Went to a school that wasn't all that great at all, but he was, you know, a phenomenal athlete and incredibly bright as well, and got into University of Chicago. So that was kind of my benchmark. I knew I wasn't going to get into University of Chicago because I wasn't the strongest student, you know, academically, especially coming out of Hillcrest. You know, it wasn't like, in my mind at least, I was going to go to University of Chicago. And so George had applied to a few different schools, and he got into UIC. So I'm like, I'm going to go to UIC as well. And so, you know, I guess I wasn't as strong academically, so like, you know, there's a bridge program if you come down over the summer and do that. So I did that, and, you know, it was a great experience, quite frankly. And ironically, I ended up at Iowa State because I went to go visit with a good friend of mine, Matthew, who you also know very well.
Shout out to Matt Smith.
Matthew, right. So Matt was, Matt was my neighbor growing up, and we're the same age, but I was always a year ahead because I skipped the grade when I was younger. And so I was already out of school for a year or so. So when George and I were down to UIC, Matthew and all the other guys would come down and just hang out because this thing is in high school. We're staying on campus. We're close enough to go home if we want to, but we're living, like, you know, for the most part, in the West Loop near downtown Chicago
at
UIC.
Yeah, so you in the spot. You in the spot.
So they'd rather come down to us. I mean, no sense of us going back to high school. You know, 28,000 students down here. Why would we go back to high school? They would come down and hang out, and stuff like that. And so Matt was like, man, you know, he was checking these different schools and wanted me to kind of wingman, you know, roll to Iowa State with him. And I honestly thought he said Ohio State. I don't think it was until we got in the car. And I'm like, what the hell are we doing on 80 West?
Like, I ain't the best geography. So you thought you was going to Ohio State to kick it?
I thought it was Buckeye time, man, I swear. I thought I was going to Ohio State, man. And so it's really ironic, though, because I don't know if Matthew remembers this, but Matthew, we would always just antagonize each other. So I was actually an Iowa fan growing up, solely because Matthew used to always talk about Illinois.
So you became an Iowa fan at first just off the street just to mess with him.
Exactly. And then Marion and Iowa had the same exact color, so, you know, that kind of makes sense. But, yeah, I went to go visit Iowa State with Matthew, and I'm like, oh, this is different. You know, like, people have, they say whatever they want to say about Iowa. I love the state of Iowa. Like, going to Iowa State and seeing that campus was one of the most beautiful things I've seen in my entire life. Like, acres, you know, like, lush grass.
Space.
Exactly. You know, it wasn't the most dense place on earth. That's for sure. It was more, you know, flat than anything else. So that was cool to me. You know, that was cool. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to transfer here. And so ultimately, that's what I did. And, you know, shortly thereafter, that's when I met you, and Trey and Marquise and Sean. Everybody else, you know. So it's been on ever since then, man, as you know.
I remember before when we was in a band of brothers together, you had mentioned that you felt like you felt your GPA was slipping more at UIC than being at Iowa State, and it got you kind of back together.
Yeah. So when I was at UIC, again, George and I were the only ones who were in college. Everybody else, it was a 30-minute drive, they coming down, hanging out, you know, that type of situation. And so, you know, they're just in high school. They're seniors. They're set. So it's not like they need to go and really, you know, do too much of the study or whatever, whereas we needed to. And so my grades were, they were all right. They certainly weren't great. And so, you know, the opportunity to go to someone like Iowa State where I figured I could focus a little bit more. Like, nobody was going to drive 5 hours to come hang out. But I also had my best friend who was going to be there too. So, you know, if I needed to rap to somebody about home, I'll go get homesick or whatever. I had my best friend that way as well. And then, you know, getting to Iowa State, as you know, we had a lot of fun. From the beginning, you know. So I can't say any of us, you know, immediately were solely focused on grades or as focused on grades as we needed to be. And that's why somebody like Dr. Blake, who really, man, plenty of books should be written about this guy, you know, his influence. And that, you know, Dr. Blake, having a band of brothers in Dr. Blake is how you end up getting connected to somebody like Ase. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, you would have known him from the journalism school, ever, but to have a really deeper connection and understand, like, how you can benchmark and look at where you were in undergrad and where you could get to based on having that, you know, that degree. I mean, that's a great opportunity. And you know, something like the Band of Brothers, which, you know, puts people in that space, you know, in an environment where you can have some candid conversations about what you're going through on campus as a professor, as a student, you know, as a teaching assistant. As a student, I mean, was absolutely necessary. Yeah, I think you remember just as well as I do. You know, there were certain folks in, you know, the Band of Brothers, professors who were just like, you know, kids from Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City. They don't do good here. They don't succeed here. I mean, we just gotta realize that and kind of, you know, keep it moving and focus on the ones that will. And that pissed me off because I'm like, I'm from one of those cities.
and you know what? And this is something that me and you, when we fought against a lot, which would end up happening in Iowa State, and it ended up happening now. And I think it's now even worse is that we've come to find out that Iowa State decided to switch up and not give any people chances that were maybe not making the cut as much. They only went after those black students that could have went into any school, could have went to Harvard, but they just gonna give them a full ride.
That was like the class of 2001. That was Sarah, Chi-Chi, and Jasmine, Rachel, and all those folks.
And they really recruited hard in Louisiana at one point. I know that. That's where they got a lot of them from.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, those were incredibly bright kids. But they were going to be fine no matter where they went.
Yep.
You know, the fact that Iowa State took the approach of, you know, we're going to just really focus on numbers and get people through. I mean, I think a decent hybrid approach would make sense. I mean, because you can't just have a bunch of people come up there and give them money and nobody graduate. That model doesn't work either. But at the same time, you know, to take solely people who, you know, you can put them anywhere in the nation and they're going to be just fine.
And then say you foster African-American studies well. Then you claim, like, exactly. We have a great, you know, African-American, you know, graduation rate. But, yeah, you would have had one anyway recruiting all those students.
Exactly. I mean, it'd be no different, you know, if you went and got all blue-chip players. You know,
and we develop players. We develop
players, and try to suggest somehow you have this great, you know, essentially a farm system or something like that or whatever. Like, no, you want to get the best that you can get. But that That wasn't our class, honestly.
No,
you know, our class
no,
was a little
no,
bit
no,
different.
No, no. Our class is like probably the last one of the last classes of the, I guess, the old Iowa State regime of like how things went.
Sure.
You know, because our class didn't have that many black people graduate in it in that spring.
I know. I remember the graduation.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's including cats that was in the classes above us that ended up graduating with us.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, the thing about Iowa State is, man, and we kind of actually talked about this a little while ago, is it was a blessing, man.
Yeah.
It was a blessing. It was a very, very quick education in rural America to some extent, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also have folks who came from a lot of different other places. I mean, you got a real education on, like, you know, some of it came with broad strokes, but how some folks from Kansas City may be, or, you know, Minneapolis, whatever the case may be. And then just really, okay, like, this is one of the first times in your life that you're going to be someone that is completely, I mean, everywhere you go is 99.9% not like you.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere you go. It's one thing when you grow up in the city or somewhere and you're like, oh, okay, I go to this good school, or, you know, 70% of the school is white, 30% is black, whatever it is. That's one thing. You know, but you can go back into your neighborhood and see folks, there may be doctors, lawyers, policemen, somebody who owns the cleaners, whatever, who look like you. You go somewhere like Iowa, and I mean, you have a 99% chance that unless you go to certain very specific places, folks are not going to look like you, you know, and how do you deal with that? How do you navigate that? I mean, you know, that's a very important lesson to learn very early on. I mean, I'm sure, you know, they're not just, you know, I'm sure that the field of journalism, you know, your field, you know, it's not 99% black.
No.
Or, you know, like,
no way.
Right. So the point is, you know, how do you navigate that? How do you deal with that? And I'm not suggesting any field should be 99% one way, but the reality of it is you have to get out of your comfort zone and realize, like, how to navigate these situations, because they're gonna occur. I mean, I went to law school, right? I mean, practice law. I mean, plenty of times, more often than not, I go to a courtroom in Cook County. Cook County is the largest unified court system in the nation, which probably means in the world, right? And I go to court all the time, and I probably 3 out of 4 times, I'll say probably 8 out of 10 times, I'm not going to see one other black person except for the clerk.
Wow. Not even a bailiff.
In the courtroom. Yeah, I mean, well, it looks like a bailiff tonight. But it's going to be either a deputy or a clerk. Somebody in a you know, a good
that works for the
you
state.
Know government union job that works for the you know the city or the state, I mean the county or the state. But as far as attorneys go, no. You know. But when you already experienced that in undergrad, you know, 19 to 22 years old, you understand how to deal with those situations and really how to read people. I mean, one of the things about Iowa, I'm sure, and we had plenty of our battles in Iowa. One thing that I definitely take away is there's a select group of people everywhere that are just idiots. They don't make a difference in Iowa.
And I look back at that too, though, man, and I wonder, man, we kind of gave them a lot more hell than they deserve sometimes. When we did all our revolutionary
acts
on campus, we kind of gave them a lot more hell than they deserve, though, comparatively.
We did. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, you start to learn things, you get all riled up. But if you take a step back, I think the important thing is to take a step back and realize that, like, man, some of these cats have never had to interact with anybody that doesn't look like them, ever, in life. I mean, you grew up for 16, 17, 18 years, and you never, ever, ever had to deal with somebody who does not look like
you. And even worse, Ames is the biggest town you've been to in your life.
Right. I mean, at that time, Ames hadn't even close to 50,000 people yet when we were in undergrad.
Yeah.
Ames finally hit 50,000 when I was in law school. I remember that. And so when you look at it, you know, the largest town that you've been in is 45,000 people, you know, and many of them are from other small towns like yours. I mean, yeah, we gave them hell. You know, some of them well deserved, some of them, you know, probably we could have eased off the gas a little bit.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we definitely ease off the gas sometimes, man. I won't get into that and everything, but
No music.
You know, and if anybody ever want to find out about Operation Snowmelt, shoot me an email. or the can incident.
Yeah, those two things that stick out of my mind as well.
Yeah. Well, no, man. So, what made you decide you wanted to be in law? Like, what was like? What made you decide? And why you decide? I know why you made decisions, but I know a lot of people listening sure. want to know like how you decide on law school and what was your first decision when you when you came to school? You were in sociology and psychology. What made you decide to like, I want to be a lawyer now, or was that always the plan?
Well, the funny thing is, when I got to Iowa State initially, I was actually a business major, and I realized after a couple classes, I didn't want to go into business. At least not in a traditional sense.
Yeah.
I had a business law class, which actually the former mayor of Ames taught, and I really enjoyed that. But once I switched majors and I was, in sociology and really just looking at different issues, playing in society, and really it was just interesting to kind of watch the pieces of society and how they work together. And then, as you know, I ended up getting involved with Dr. DeLisi doing some research on race, ethnicity, and habitual offending, things like that. I was involved with Dr. Blake and learning a lot more about African American studies and things. I really realized, like, for me, I always wanted to be able to help people in some kind of capacity. But, I wasn't going to be the biochem major trying to go to medical school. Like, that's not my thing. I knew that the law was a flexible degree and it would allow me to help people. Also, I felt like overall, everybody needs a strong advocate. No matter what, everybody's a strong advocate. You don't have to be a lawyer to be an advocate, but it's certainly a very, very good way to, try to make sure that the scales are balanced. So that was kind of the impetus of it. And I wanted to right some wrongs, at least what I saw, to be wrong. And I think one of the approaches is to just kind of sit on the outside and say, hey, this is wrong, this should change. The other approach is to get into the system, really understand it. And once you get in and understand the system, then you actually are more in a better position to actually say, is this wrong?
Yeah.
start from there.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of things seem wrong from the outside, but once you understand the law and how things work, it gives you a better opportunity to really understand, how to help people. So that was my thing, man. I wanted to help people. And I knew being an attorney would allow me to do so. And so, I applied to a handful of schools. And Iowa, just, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I still love the state of Iowa. At that time, I wanted to be in the state of Iowa. My girlfriend at the time was at Iowa State. So I was in between, her and home. So that worked out. And, the University of Iowa set a stellar reputation. I think the year of our class, it was number 17 in the nation and the top 10 public schools. So it was kind of a no-brainer to go there.
Was there any other schools you were looking at? What was the second-place school, like if University of Iowa, what didn't exist? What was the other place you was going to go?
It would have been Ohio State, or the Ohio State, I guess. But that would have been my second choice.
That would have been interesting, you in Ohio and State.
Yes, it would have. It would have. I don't know if I would have. I wonder if I say him then there's a real question.
Yeah, he left our senior year, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So I ended up winning out. It made a lot of sense. And I don't regret that decision one day, man. I had a great experience down there.
How was that experience comparatively to being in Ames, being in Iowa City? Was it different since you were older and being in Iowa and understanding the layout, or was it like you just, I'm in the books and I'm just,
Well, you know what, it was a little bit different because I had the experience of Iowa State to prepare me to be at Iowa, right? I wasn't culture shocked. It wasn't, astonishing to be in a classroom full of folks who don't necessarily look like me. What was funny, I actually confirmed this more recently with somebody, and I won't put their name out there, but when I was in law school my first year, it was one of those Michigan cases, one of the affirmative action cases. I remember being in constitutional law, one of my favorite professors in law school, and somebody raised their hand and pretty much suggested the only reason there was anybody black in law school at Iowa was because of affirmative action. Right.
Wow.
And so this will give you the reaction. What was Iowa like? Understand this, the same people who went to Iowa State undergrad, if they were not cool people there, they weren't cool in law school either.
Right.
That's just the reality of it. And so come to find out, the University of Iowa actually, for some period of time, held 70% of the seats for Iowa residents. It's the biggest unheard of affirmative action program in the nation, probably, right? To me, at least. I mean, what do you think those students look like?
Yeah.
You got 20 students in a class, and you hold 140 seats for them, for people from Iowa. You know, so, you know, what were they else at school? What were their GPA? Things like that. I think that's kind of indicative of some of my experience at Iowa, where you have folks who just could not let it go. You know, you're in law school where, you know, your profession is going to be about research, writing, and articulating things. And you have somebody, you know, as a first or second year, who has clearly done no research at all, making blanket statements, and passing off as gospel. So being older in Iowa City was definitely advantageous, because I would have been down there in undergrad with the Ted mom and all those bars and things like that. It would have been rough.
Right.
Being in law school, you know, I was about the books. I mean, I went out, you know, occasionally, but I was mostly focused on the books because I knew I was going from undergrad straight to law school, so I didn't take any time off. I wasn't going to have, like, the work experience other people had. So I needed to at least be a pretty good student in law school if I wanted to go out and learn, you know, and I'm using air quotes that you can't see, you know, a good job.
So your plan from the law was to come out and do what particular law? What did you go into? What law did you go into?
So I knew I was going to be in litigation generally, meaning in court. I didn't really have a burning desire. When I first started law school, I thought that I wanted to go into criminal law. Actually, at one point, thought about being a public defender. I thought that I could actually help folks that way. And then I realized, you know, after doing an internship, like, once you get some of these kids to the system, even if you get them off on a case, like, you beat a case, and they're coming right back, unfortunately. Like, it's a cycle. And so just being a public defender and just representing people and getting them back out on the street, to me, just wasn't enough. I mean, it's a job that somebody has to do, and I appreciate that, but I just think I would have ended up burned out at some point and not really feeling all that fulfilled. And so I thought, well, I still want to be involved in litigation. You know, I was on the civil side. So most of what I did when I first came out of law school was defense work. So it could be, you know, maybe a personal injury or premises liability case. And we would always represent the insurance company. And unfortunately, I really mean unfortunately, at one point we represented Cook County and the deputies who were accused of, you know, excessive force and things like that. And that's what I knew. I had to leave the firm. Like,
really? So that was a real issue. Like, I can't do this.
Not in good conscience. I mean, I could not do it in good conscience. And that's not to say that everybody who was accused of something had done something wrong. I just knew that for me, things were not adding up. That's the best that I can say. Things just weren't adding up. And again, I knew that I would feel unfulfilled. I'm not really doing what I would want to do. And so I left there, also went to the mayor's office and enjoyed that experience for what it was. Learned a lot. Met a lot of people. It's the first time in my life that, you know, people would take my business card and keep it. And they wanted to reach out to me. Right, because everybody wants a favor. Everybody wants a favor
right
when they think
that
you have to see a power to some extent. So, you know, I would get phone calls and requests for all kinds of different things, but it taught me how to get things done. And actually, when I went to the mayor's office, I had an opportunity to go to the mayor's office or to potentially go to another firm. Now, this will show you this will show you two things. One, how much I wanted to get out of what I was doing. I wanted to switch and do real estate.
out the whole game, period.
Yeah, I just do real estate. But this is, you know, 2007, 2008,
yeah,
whatever.
And you know it's going to happen the next year.
yeah. So that would have been a terrible move. And so I remember talking to this gentleman, an older Jewish cat. And I just emphasized that to show, like, it wasn't somebody who, you know, had grown up or anything like that. This is a guy who's a lawyer, had been a lawyer for, you know, 40 years or so. He was also a real estate developer. So there's nobody better to really talk to about this. And so I talked to him and gave him the perspective. And he said, you know, go to the mayor's office, hands down. I'm like, you don't understand. He's like, go to the mayor's office. I'm like, I'm about to get married. He's like, go to the mayor's office. I'm trying to buy a house. Go to the mayor's office. I'm like, shit. All right. I mean, so, like, I really couldn't understand why initially. But what he told me was absolutely true. You see the city from the top down. You get to see how every department works, how things interact, you know, how, you know, politicians work with each other to passed different things in the city council. And so it was a good experience, man. And what it allowed me to do was, like, for instance, my law partner now, we had known each other, but he reached out to me for a favor. He wanted a resolution for his daughter's school. I think it was like their 50th anniversary or something like that. And so he reaches out to me, he's like, can you give me a resolution? Well, I learned. So it's kind of cool. Like, you know what? I don't know, man. I have to see. You know, I do the best that I can. But I knew if I got him that resolution from the mayor.
Explain that for some people that may not know what a resolution is.
Sure. So just a resolution, like kind of commending the school for being around, you know, for 50 years. I'm going to direct congratulations from the mayor.
Got you. Okay.
Right. The mayor will sign off on it, that type of stuff. Just like you see when they'll say, oh, this is, you know, honorary, you know, Dale Frierson Day.
Right. Proclamated, you know, by the mayor, typically stuff like that. Yeah,
exactly. And so I knew that it would be a big deal for him, right? He gets to, you know, go back to the school with that resolution. They're going to look at him and say, damn, that dude, yeah, you know, he gets things done, right? And so I told him I didn't know how I could do it. But realistically, there was somebody who, you know, would draft those things and hand a stack to the mayor so he could sign off on it, right? So, I mean, I was pretty sure he'd actually get done. And so, you know, I was able to get that for him, and he never forgot it. So things like that are what you learn when you're working in government. You know, when you come out and you're practicing law and you're just keeping your head down and doing document review and things like that, you don't really learn how to grow your practice. You don't learn how to manage a business. You don't know, you don't learn. They don't teach in a law school or undergrad, unfortunately, how to go out, you know, and conduct yourself at a, you know, at a function, at a black tie function, or, you know, happy hours, whatever it may be, you know, to be involved with a trade association and things like that. And to find positions, you know, publish things if you can. Like, nobody really teaches you or talks to you about those types of things. And so I was lucky to have been in the mayor's office and saw how those things work, at least on the government side. And it really catapulted my career, because after that, again, I built a nice little database of people who kept my contact information. I knew everybody. And so when it was time for me, when I ultimately decided to start a firm, it wasn't difficult to reach out and have people at least send me something to keep the lights on.
Right, to get the referrals.
You know, I know. Yeah, exactly.
So what made you start the firm? What was the impetus for you starting the firm?
So much like my impetus from going to the mayor's office, that I hated the firm where I was and what I was doing, I ended up working for the Independent Police Review Authority in Chicago for a year. I was the director of public affairs, and that's a department that investigates police misconduct, primarily police involved shootings and excessive force. I went out on 62 shootings in a year, and it was too much for me. I mean, literally.
So you literally went from one job helping out on the insurance side for policemen to another job doing the almost exact same thing, but on the inside.
Well, so the thing was, our department was an independent department, at least in title. And so they would investigate the police. But the problem for me was, you know, it was the first time in my life that I was actually hated by every side, right? But I learned so much in the experience. And I'll give you an example. You know, the police obviously don't like us on this thing because the folks in my department were investigating them, right? That's right. Pretty obvious. Well, the community didn't really like us, and again, this all flows back to me, because they feel like we're just there to take up for the police anyway. It's not going to be a thorough investigation. We're going to say the shooting was justified, and that's going to be a case closed. Because it's not, I'm back, you know, 0-2. And the media doesn't like me because they want the soundbite. You know, what happened? What's on the investigation? You know, and the thing that people have to realize is, while you want the immediate what happened, the problem is, you know, you put that on Channel 7 News and you might paint a jury pool because people have seen that story and they've already kind of heard what supposedly happened. An officer or somebody could watch the news and then change their story to match whatever it needs to. So, I mean, that was the reason why you wanted to kind of keep it tight-lipped. But now you're batting 0-3.
So you know? Everybody hates you.
And so everybody hates you. So I will tell you this. The reason why I started the firm is that I tried doing that, for one. I could not continue to talk to mothers who lost their sons. I mean, you're looking at your son laying there, like rigor mortis is setting in, and he's laying there dead. Like, this one is one of the times you can get that in the middle of the night, man, and they're not really starting to affect you. So that torch had to be passed to somebody else to do that. So the other thing was, I had the best boss I could absolutely have, like the best. I mean, I love her to this day. And I had all the flexibility that I needed. She was not checking for me every 5 minutes. She knew that I was good at what I did, and she allowed me to do it. And when, again, I didn't necessarily feel fulfilled in that role, I knew it was time for me to go. Because I'm like, I'm not going to have a better boss than this. And that really was, I'm serious, that really was one of the things that made it, helped me make the decision. I was making good money. That wasn't an issue. You know, I had a signed car I could drive where I needed to go. You know, I mean, anything that I needed in that regard, I was taken care of. But for me, the thought process was relatively simple. If there's no way I can imagine working for somebody who's better than this person, and I'm still like, even with all that, this is not enough, I need to go work for myself.
Yes.
I need to go work for myself at some point. And that's what it boiled down to. That's what it boiled down to.
And so what made you decide to go into, I guess, you know, representing people in their lawsuits and things like that? Like, what was the emphasis on that instead of going into a different route with the firm?
Well, you know, I had already been on the defense side and realized the defense is not what I wanted to do. it's just not. I mean, I think that, you know, there are plenty of really fine defense lawyers out there, and there are plenty of cases that just don't really belong. People file things all the time just to kind of throw, you know, spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. But I knew the life of a defense lawyer to me, at those types of firms, I mean, you build a lot of hours. You get to a certain point, you hope to make partner. You know, you make partner, you got to build a lot of hours and then develop business at the same time. And I'm like,
I was just talking to somebody about that on Saturday. I was just talking to Lexi's husband, Ali, about that. He was saying, like, yeah, he didn't want to be a partner because he's like, dude, you gotta build, get business too, and build your hours. Like, you got to be going and get business
simultaneously.
Too.
Yeah, simultaneously. And so, you know, the question for me always became very simple. When I came out of law school, I remember, you know, the salaries were going up for the largest law firms, not your medium, but your large law firms. You know, they'd gone up from like 125 to 160, I mean, over the course of the year. Like,
wow,
that was the starting salary.
40 grand in 1 year?
Yeah, I remember. Wow. So, you know, if you look at that, you say, okay, well, 160 grand, they want me to bill $2,000. Now, if you assume every hour you work is the hour that you bill, which is not true, especially as an associate, very early on, you're probably working, you know, 70 hours and billing like 35, 40 at the most, because you don't know what you're doing anyway. So, I mean, and nobody's going to pay for your learning curve, right? So let's use that as basic math. So pretty much what it boils down to is $80 an hour. So at some point, the question to me was, well, hell, if I get $1,000 by myself, I guess somebody's paying me $160. I mean, that's the calculus. You know, do I want to spend 7, 8, 10 years or whatever? And I remember the formula for my firm, at least, like, pretty much, if they build you out for $4, you got paid one of those dollars. Mm-hmm. Like, the other three was being divided up by everybody else. And I remember bringing things in and not getting credit for it at the time. So it just didn't make a lot of sense to me to go that route. The other thing was, I wanted to be in a position where I could kind of control my practice, and being on the plaintiff side helps with that a lot. Because, for instance, let's say it's an auto accident, just a very simple example. I mean, I have 2 years to file a suit. I could take a year and a half just going back and forth with the adjuster if I wanted to try to settle the case. You know, I mean, now, granted, I would talk to the client that'd be on board, so on and so on, but I'm not pressed to file a lawsuit, like, immediately. I can spend the entire summer just trying to settle cases and then file them all in September if I want to be busy in the winter. Like, if I want to push the gas in my case, then I can. If I want to ease off, I can't. The defense side, they're always beholden to us to some extent. Mm. And I don't want to be in another position where, even though I was making good money, that I was always beholden to somebody else who can drive the case. So it just didn't make sense. And then on top of all of that, getting back to my original point when you asked me about law school, I wanted to help folks out. And I wanted to help, like, people out. And that's not to say that, you know, Walmart or Target or other people, you know, don't need help in certain situations, but they didn't need my help.
Not in that chores, because you can do more about helping people around there. How'd you get with you know, with your partner, Gukina,
and
I'm gonna work with you, Keenan. We're gonna do this together.
So Keenan and I knew each other from being on the board together for my first law firm. So we kind of had that going on. I knew that he was looking to leave his he had downsized actually at a large firm. I knew that had happened with him, and I was looking to leave the city. And so it really was one of those things where, I mean, he came over to my back deck, smoked a cigar, I believe, and just kind of spitballing, like, what would it be like to have a firm together? And
that's how a lot of ideas, you know, happen, man.
yeah. And so we put it together, man. It's been almost 6 years now. And the good thing about it is now it's not a firm. It really is a family. Like, I love that dude. Like, that's my brother. You know, I love his family. He loves, you know, my family. I love my family as well. And so, you know, we've been incredibly successful, especially like the last 2 years. And a huge part of it is because we're not worried about how to develop the pie. It's not like, you know, you're these large law firms and it's time to do bonuses and things like that. I mean, it's like a bloodbath. You know, like these people in the room, as soon as makes it out, you know, we sit down and it's like, okay, well,
so
you brought this case in.
So those bonuses, there's not like a set thing saying like you get this amount. You got to go and negotiate your bonus at the end?
A lot of times the partners, they sit down and just try to figure out, they divide the pie up. The pie is out there. They get numbers every month, every quarter, whatever it is. They figure out what they're going to give people. So it may be based on the fact that you have built an insane amount of hours, maybe based on the fact that you brought in some different clients. But the bottom line is somebody else is always determining what your bonus is. And remember, your bonus, if the formula is true, which I know that it is, if they bill you out of $4 and pay you one of them, your bonus is just one of those other $3 that was sitting out there anyway. it's not even a huge portion of that. I mean, they bill you off for $4 and pay you one, then they're probably going to give you like $1.15. Like, I mean, yeah. It's not going to be $1.50, it's not going to be $2, you know. So, you know, it's enough to keep you to come back. With us, we can sit down and say, you know what, man, you know, this is my case, I originated it, so on and so on, but I really need your help for trial. So, you know, we get a judgment, and we can figure out, what does that make sense? Oh, trial was a week, you know. Why don't you take whatever number for your help? I appreciate it. I mean, those types of things we're able to do because we're small, we're nimble, and because we know each other, we like each other, and we, because of all that, we get to see the bigger picture. We know that, you know, this case is not our last case. You know, there'll be an opportunity, and things tend to balance out. You know, sometimes the case is just flowing to me. Sometimes it's just flowing to Kenan. But that's the good thing about having a partner, that ultimately things should balance out. And they have so far. We've been incredibly blessed.
Do you all have any other associates or anyone that works for you all?
I think you know one very well. Actually, Crystal, my youngest sister.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So she's working with us and driving me crazy at the same time.
she trying to get this. She knows that her big bro going to take care of her, though.
Yeah, man, she's solid, though. I mean, that's the thing, you know. It's a cool experience, I would say, to be able to work alongside my sister. I mean, I've seen it in so many other instances with other people and other firms and things like that. But the experience of being able to do it, you know, where I know for a fact that the two people at our firm who I'm kind of lining up back-to-back with, they truly have my back for real. They care about, you know, my best interest. They're going to look out for me even beyond the practice of law. And those types of things, you know, they really help us to be successful.
So, all right, let's get transitioned into this beer thing, man. So, how did the beer thing come on?
That
in itself, though, man, like, I remember when you started messing with the tinkering with the beer thing, I was like, this dude finna try to kill people on some moonshine up in his house, man. He's trying to kill people, you know. So, how did that whole thing come about to get the beer thing popping on Vice District?
So, I'm gonna tell you what, man, it's really funny. Obviously, you know, Matthew, his old man. Mr. Smith used to make beer when we were growing up.
Really? I did not know that.
I thought that was the craziest thing, man. I tasted a couple of batches, and then, you know, I didn't really have an appreciation for beer. My first beer, I was 7 years old, was the Old Style.
Oh, snap. Said, the lowest grade you can get, almost.
Exactly. Like, go get my beer off the counter. I'm like, okay. I took a sip off of it. You know, I damn near swore beer off forever. But Mr. Smith used to homebrew, and I wasn't a huge fan of the beer that he would make, but part of it was because hey, I didn't know what a Belgian beer was. You know, like, I had no idea that beer was probably tasting as it was supposed to taste for the style guideline. You know, all I knew was Old Style was my benchmark. And so I was like, you know what? At one point, I was like, I think I want to start home or just kind of do something to do. And so I was talking to my neighbor about it. He's like, you know what, man? I have a patient. He's a physical therapist. I have a patient with home brews. Don't worry about buying any equipment. We can go use his stuff and then, you know, see how it works out. I'm like, I'm not driving to Indiana to homebrew. Like, homebrew means I'm brewing in my dad's
house.
Like,
at home.
Like, yeah, at home. Like, you know. So I bought a kit, made a beer. You know, it was consumable. It was drinkable. I say that. You know, you can consume it without dying.
Okay, yeah, that's
but it wasn't great. It wasn't great. You know, it was one of those things that made me learn that I was a hothead. I was like, you know what? Put some more hot sugar. Make it more bitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it was decent. So then, you know, Quentin ended up, you know, getting some equipment. He started brewing as well. And then from there, it became, you know, like we always say, it was from a hobby to a passion to an addiction to some extent. And not an addiction like drinking beer and getting drunk, yeah. Although we did a decent amount of that. And you gotta remember, we live 60 feet from each other. So really, on most nights, the goal was just to make it home. You're not harming anybody. You're not behind the wheel. You don't need an Uber, right? All you gotta do is make it home. Yeah, you walk across the street. And so,
in the finest shit, live out my dreams until my heart get bound and what we crave. You know exactly what this shit's about, fuck y'all mean, handling since a teen, got this shout, like the point guard of your favorite team, without doubt. My life ain't rosy, but I roll with it. My mind was fine till the dough hit it and told me that the mold did it, and now it's kosher, shit is so acidic. I blow a digit on the diamond in a minute, but no bitches, watch how I'm walking, cause even the thoroughest niggas be knocking, trying to strike a bargain, hoping that they might get pardoned. Shit, I'm involved, we got me pins and needles, and my cerebral beats the wickedest evil thoughts that this water feed you. Be back in the game so deep, things can catch a freeze off my kneecap. Can y'all believe that? Got the city drinking Chris Styles, we up the feet. Rappers going broke, trying to keep up with me. My rise to riches, surprise the bitches, think harder. You know this nigga, Jay-Z, Sean Carter, GS the fuck up, Dries the fuck up. Watch me shine like a bright, let me get the fuck up. All rhymers, forget it, like Alzheimer's, small timers. I said it, I'm addressing all drama. Talk to me.
That really gave us a platform to just try some crazy recipes and things like that. So we did that. Then we joined the homebrew club, where we really started to, see what people were doing, find out different recipes, you know, kind of best practices to some extent. And we got bit by the bug. And so we were having what somewhat loosely defined as drunk talk. And we kept talking about, like, wanting to open up a sports bar. It was like, we like sports and this, that, and the other. They're like, what about a brewery? Which was the most asinine thing.
First of all, for two black dudes to be like, we just gonna open up a brewery.
Two black dudes to a home brewery. One of the lawyers wanted to get there.
On the south side of Chicago. Brewery, right? On the south side of Chicago.
On the south side of Chicago. Yeah, you know, a half mile from Obama's house, right? So, I mean, like, literally, we this sounds kind of crazy. All right, fine, whatever. We're working on a business plan. Okay, fine. We're gonna send the business plan out to these folks on this group, and see, you know, if anybody bites. If somebody bites, maybe we're on to something. We sent the business plan back out on a Friday evening, and like by Sunday, we raised all the money we needed on the equity side. We're like, shit.
Hold on. So you, so you gotta write it back to somebody sitting there taking some notes. Like, oh no, somebody threw their pencil, man. Because you said on Friday and on Sunday. So what was it a group of investors you sent this to, or was this like,
what was the plug
to be able to send this to somebody on a Friday?
So here's the funny thing about it. I had not had an investment. I didn't know what an investment group was. So I have a crew, and you come back, you come to my birthday or whatever, but we grab breakfast like every 6 weeks. It's a group of brothers, and we grab breakfast like every 6 weeks or so. So really, the only thing I thought to do was send it to the breakfast group. But that was because, so I went to this place years ago called the Union League Club with this older attorney. I'm like, Tom, how did you find this place? He's like, oh, you know, my investment club meets here. I'm like, well, Tom, I didn't grow up with an investment club. You know, kind of walk me through how that happened. And he literally was like, oh, we used to just grab breakfast all the time. You know, you should do something like that one day. I'm like, cool, whatever. So I took him at his word, just started having, you know, breakfast with folks. But primarily just to kind of catch up. You know, it's hard to catch up with 50 guys, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can do drinks once a week for a year. Yeah, so you get everybody together in one town. You put everybody in a room so people kind of know what each other is doing, and you feed off that energy. And so my thought was, I don't know who to send to my family. I didn't really think I'm crazy. Yeah. They thought I was crazy when I left that, you know, quote-unquote good city job to start a law firm. They thought I was absolutely nuts. You know, like, you're going to get the attention and all that kind of stuff. And so I was like, well, I'm going to listen to this group and see what people say. Like, you know, see if anybody's going to be interested. And so I had folks give me back, like, pretty much immediately. It was to the point that, like, by Monday, we sent the email, like, look, if you haven't already committed, we probably can't take your money. Because we had a certain amount of equity we were willing to give up. Yeah.
Right. Like on being on Shark Tank. It's like being on Shark Tank, you know, yeah. Like how much equity you'll give.
Exactly. And so, so we raised it. And at that point, it's like, okay, we have people's money, or people at least committed to give us money. We got to get really, you know, even more serious about this. And that's what it was, man. And, you know, here we are 2 years later, and we're opening up our second location, you know, in early 2017.
So where's the first location? Let's go back. Like, how'd you come up with the first location? Let people know where it is, though, as well, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, the best landmark for where we are is, you know, 3 blocks west of Soldier Field. So we're on 14th and Michigan, which is the South Loop in Chicago. And so we live in two different areas in Chicago. And to be very clear, we wanted to be on the south side. We had no intent to go north at all. North side is doing fine. It's incredibly dense. There's already a lot of places up that way. And it just didn't make sense to be two guys from the south side who went to the north side to open a brewery. It just seemed counterintuitive to us. And so Hyde Park, selfishly, was because we live, you know, within
y'all trying to
a
walk
2 minute drive. Yeah, exactly. So that was part of it. But the thing with Hyde Park was the University of Chicago had just come through and they were raising all the rental rates and they had bought everything up. And so it was going to cost us half as much or so to be in the South Loop as it was to be in Hyde Park. And what we found was there was a huge gap or a huge opportunity for us to be in the South Loop. There was so much money for our type of a concept, a weekend out of the neighborhood anyway, that putting something there that people could walk to, you know, made sense. So we were going to be the ground level retail of an apartment building is what we were really hoping for. We end up being a ground level retail right next to a condo building. So it kind of gives us the built-in, okay, there's 300 people who live in this building. You know, worst case scenario, somebody's going to come down for a beer, even if it's, you know, 50 below zero. You know, we really wanted to kind of hedge our bets. We wanted to be close to Soldier Field. We hope the damn Bears will win, you know, occasionally. And then that would be good for us because it would bring so many tourists and stuff like that. And so that helped us out. And we're not sure we found a few museums and other places like that. So we opened up in the South Loop, and it's been phenomenal. It's been absolutely phenomenal. The neighborhood responded very well to us. And
how many people know that it's a black dudes that own this spot, though, man? I mean, you got to think about this.
They do at this
brewery.
Point.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's got to at this point because y'all have done so much media and stuff like that. It's too late. But in general, people wouldn't expect two black dudes from the South Side, you know, regular black dudes, you know, when I say that, I mean the regular brothers that you would know anywhere you would meet, own a brewery, you know, like, ain't nobody would just walk up on you and be like, man, you own a brewery, don't you?
Right. No, I agree. I mean, not before September of 2014. And it's funny, man, because we have a really huge picture, almost like a mural in there, and it's all white people. People are like, is this black on? Like, yeah, what are black people in the picture? I'm like,
so they're trying to sell you on Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, but I'm like the black people are probably in the fucking kitchen. I mean, like, this place is hundreds of years old. You know, like, we can have that conversation, you know. And so, but the reality of it is that we never hid the fact that we're black on, but we also didn't feel the need to beat people over the head and say, hey, you know, we're black on brewery. And for very simple reasons, breweries tend to have a different communal feel and stuff like that. Like, there's not very much divisive stuff going on in breweries. I mean, that's just the reality. People grab a beer, especially a craft beer, and it's just a nice, mellow environment. You don't have a lot of, you know, BS back and forth. And so the other thing is we wanted to make sure that people tasted the beer, enjoyed the beer, and then they make that determination of how good the beer is, just knowing that they tasted it, right, experienced it. as opposed to, you know, walking in the door like, oh, that's a black-owned brewery. Yeah, he's a lawyer. He's a physical therapist. We're going to have some lower standards for them. Like, no, we want you to put us on par with everybody else and judge us accordingly, because that's how we approach ourselves.
How was it having employees and all that kind of stuff? Like, how, I guess, day-to-day operations, how much are you involved in the day-to-day operations?
Well, let me ask you a question about having employees. I have two kids, so it ain't very much different.
Yeah.
in that regard. And by that, I mean, you know, and I don't, this is not to be disparaging to our employees. I mean that in the sense of, you know, people tend to do what you allow them to get away with, right? I mean, kids spend all their time trying to figure out, when you tell them no, how to get you either to say yes or how to do the same exact thing you just said no to and not get in trouble.
That's
kind of how they operate with them. So, I mean, it's good having employees. I mean, we try to find people who, A, like beer, B, like people, and like the combination thereof, quite frankly. So we've been incredibly fortunate. You know, we've had some turnover, but
yeah,
overall,
I mean, that's going to happen.
Yeah, but we have pretty good staff. It's just a matter of, you know, it's an interesting thing I was thinking about earlier. Our interests are rarely aligned, right? Like, I mean, we want to sell a reasonable amount of beer, and I say that very specifically because, like, I don't want to sell somebody seven beers and they go wrap themselves around a tree.
Right, and then you're liable.
You know what I'm saying? Exactly. But you also have to realize that bartenders, you know, they get paid tips. So the higher, and it's always, I mean, typically a percentage, you look at the screen, a percentage of what the bill is. So, you know, the more they sell, whether it's beer or t-shirts, whatever else it is, you know, the higher likelihood, you know, they're going to get a bigger tip. Well, that doesn't necessarily align for us. I'd much rather lose $7 or $5 on a beer and not have somebody wrap themselves around a tree, you know, than to get that, you know, than to get that extra couple of bucks or whatever. And I'm not saying that, you know, our bartenders in any kind of way are just overselling people. That actually does not happen. But you have to constantly, you know, monitor those types of things. You know, you have a cash register. Maybe on top of those types of things, you don't have things in place. But as far as day-to-day operations, the place, to some extent, it's like, I don't say that it runs itself, but it doesn't need me or my business partner there every waking moment like it did when we first opened. You know, we have staff who've been there for a while. They know what to do. They've proven themselves to be trustworthy. As trustworthy, you know, as you can expect in a situation.
Yeah.
In a situation. So it's good. You know, the thing I really like is, we're actually looking for a general manager now, but our former general manager is a woman. Our head brewer is a woman. So you talk about, you know, the fact that we're a black-owned brewery. I mean, the cool thing is, a black-owned brewery, but the two senior people at the brewery, people who really make things tick, are women. You know, and have been women. And the really cool thing about our head brewer is that she was the manager of the homebrew shop we used to go to when we started homebrewing.
Wow.
Yeah, things come full circle.
Wow.
They come full circle. I'm sure she can. You know, we would come in there, and we were just homebrewing. Like, I mean, you know, picking her brain for things. I'm sure she didn't think that, you know, a year or two later, whatever it was, we'd be opening up a brewery, and she'd be out here at brewer. So that's how the universe works.
So with the place, is it only beer you all sell, or do you all sell liquor, or just beer?
So now, I mean, it's complicated with the
liquor license, right?
With the liquor, yeah. But suffice it to say, at this point, we sell a limited selection of spirits, mostly like whiskeys, and then we sell wine as well. The wine that we sell is actually a black woman-owned company, Love Corkscrew, Krishan Lampley, it's her company. And so exclusively sell her wine, which is kind of cool to be in a position to do that because, you know, we don't have any where we can walk in and say, well, this is a black-owned establishment. They don't give us a shot and put our beer on tap because we're black.
Right.
I mean, I think it's, I don't say that from everybody, but certainly that's the case for many people. Right? There's that built-in network where somebody can walk in. But, oh, you know, Smitty, that's Smitty's son. Put his beer on tap. Okay, no problem. You know?
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily have that at all times. So it's cool.
Was there any pushback or, like, I guess, hurdles for you all getting this going? Or, you know, that people, you know, like, damn, man, like, dude, we had to go through this to get this going.
So, yes and no. No, in the sense that, remember I told you I think it's come full circle when somebody told me go to the city and see it from the top down. Well, having worked in the city, I knew the process for a liquor license. I knew who ultimately I was going to have to talk to if things went awry. Like, I mean, so for example, I knew that the police were going to come interview us before we got a liquor license. I knew that, right? I knew that they were going to want to know one very simple question with us being two black dudes opening a bar, that's what it is in their mind, in the South Loop. Is it going to be a club? And that's exactly what they asked. Now, some people may say that's wrong, or racist, or this, that, and the other, but it was good to let us be the question on the front end.
Right, and you know, to answer that question.
Yeah. Yeah, you knew that was going to be there. And so, so as far as what some of the hurdles were, trying to lock down a loan initially was a little bit of a hurdle. Because in this space, we rented the facility. We rent the facility. We don't own it. The second place, we bought the facility. And so just as far as our terms and assets and things like that, the bank is a lot happier. Like, look, if this thing goes awry, we'll take the building and the equipment, you know, and then we'll come after your house, you know. So
yeah.
Whereas, you know, this first project was more or less like, okay, how much cash do you guys have? You know, like Richard Price said, you know, put it in the suitcase, let me see it.
Yeah. They're like, nah.
You know, bring it over. So, but we didn't have too many hurdles, man. I think, you know, there's a couple of little headaches here and there with the feds of the state because they don't necessarily understand, like, our legal structure. But that's kind of part of it, of course. Overall, I take it that we had one issue where an inspector from the city came in. We had bought these bar stools. We had built the bar. And the stools are specially made for the height of the bar. And the inspector comes in and says, you have plumbing in the bar. Like, yeah, we have to have plumbing in the bar by code. We have to have water to wash dishes and wash our hands and things like that. Mm-hmm. He's like, raise the bar 1 foot. We thought he was joking. We had to raise our bar up a foot. We raised the bar up a foot, and the stools were built for something that was a foot lower. We had this big gap where everybody looked like, you know, they sit at the kid table, you know, or a kid sitting at the big table where, like, you know, you're sitting a foot and a half or 2 feet
below,
lower than the bar, you know. So we ended up having to retrofit that whole situation and raise the bar stools and stuff like that up. You know, it ain't the worst thing on earth, but was it, you know, $5,000-$6,000 we expected to spend? No, it wasn't.
Yeah. So like the expansion, like, so what do you all made you all to do a second location? And I guess what is the future, you know, for Vice District from, you know, going forward?
Well, there was a need. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. So when we first went to our lenders, Chase, when we first went to Chase, we said, hey, look, we think we're onto something. You know, the story of being the first black owned building in Illinois is actually a cool story. So you kind of latch onto that as well. And so you can be able to pretty good brand. We want to go into production. But what happened off Michigan was, and that's how Luke, we were putting beer out. I had 20 outside accounts and we had no sales person. It was literally me. Like, I would go from court, grab some bottles or keg.
Oh, so hold on. Around, you was know, delivering like you the Budweiser man?
Yeah. And a damn suit. You know, some days in the suit, I was going straight from court or, you know, I grab a t-shirt. But we had these outside accounts. What we found out very quickly was we couldn't serve the outside account and the inside account.
Because the production you couldn't produce
exactly
that much.
Couldn't produce enough. And so we went back to Chase and said, hey, remember we told you we wouldn't do production? You know, it's about that time, we think. You know, we looked over the numbers and so on. And they agreed. And so the purpose of the place in Homewood is primarily to get beer brewed and out into production, into distribution, excuse me. But we'll have a tap room on site there as well. So it really was a need more so than just a want. I mean, quite frankly, I don't want to have an additional
location
tap room
to worry about.
You know, location, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you know. But it's really more of a kind of a necessity. If we're going to expand, then it's necessary. If we just want to have one tap room, you know, that's open, you know, 7 hours a night throughout the week and, you know, 12, 13 hours on the weekend, and make, you know, decent money, then sure, we could just have the tap room in the South Loop. But nah, I mean, ultimately the goal is to get beer out into distribution.
So, and y'all cats trying to expand? Y'all trying to expand? Y'all trying to get y'all Tony Montana on and move it state to state? Or?
Hey man, that's the ultimate goal. Yeah, I mean, you know, the initial goal is get the production side up and running, make good quality beer, and then from there, you know, get it to the right distributors who can get it where it needs to go.
Cause so you Absolutely. All still have to go through a main distributor after you all make it, like a lot of other people do, and like Anheuser-Busch doesn't do that. Like people don't understand like how Anheuser-Busch they have different distributors within every city that actually will take it out to their accounts for them.
Yeah, it's essentially a 3-tier system, which means you have somebody that makes it, somebody that gets to where it's going, and somebody that purchases it. And so that's the 3 tiers. Different states have different laws. In Illinois, you can self-distribute, meaning you can go to your own beer places.
Oh, so you have to go through a distributor. Barrels. Missouri, you got to go through a distributor.
Well, up to 7,500 barrels, which means up to 15,000 kegs. Now, the reality of it is most people don't self-distribute. Because most people are not trying to buy a van and hire the staff to do it. No, they really pay a percentage of whatever they sell, essentially to the distributor. So there's that option. For us, I'm not exactly positive which route we'll go right now. We could self-distribute, but it really depends. I think ultimately we'll go with a distributor. It's pretty much right from the jump. Because we want to get beer to more places. And the notion of, again, just buying more equipment and buying another vehicle and those types of things may not make sense in the long run.
Sorry, let's get into a little bit of Chicago situations, man. You're a Chicago born, home and raised. Everybody kind of, as they say, shits on Chicago for all the different stuff that happens, violence wise. Sure. Hadiya Pendleton was killed down the street from your crib. If people remember that,
she collapsed like literally right in front of my house.
Oh wow! So she came down towards your crib, like walking past, like and fell in front of your crib.
Yeah. My understanding, I wasn't here. Actually, my business partner, Ryan, who called me, she had been shot at the park. I think the kid, like, they were trying to run. I don't know if she even realized that she was shot, and then she collapsed. I remember coming home, and I mean, no joke, seeing like a soaked T-shirt, blood in my garbage can, and had no idea this was about to be national news. I mean, it was damn sure news to us because we hadn't had anything like that over this way. That Hadiya situation was just horrible, man, and really indicative of just how silly some of these, these situations are where somebody thinks they saw somebody and decided to shoot into a damn crowd, and, and if the person gets shot and killed, man.
So what do you think this problem or issue of Chicago with this eruption of violence, people say, I think that's kind of overkill, but when people have that perspective of, this explosion of violence in Chicago, what do you think the reason for that is from your perspective of being from the South Side, living in that area?
I mean, there's not enough time in the day, but I would say a few things. One homicide is too many, right? One armed robbery is too many. So we can agree to that. But if you look at it, we're on pace of 600 murders this year, and people are like up in arms. And they should be, because one is too many. But when you look at the 90s,
I was going to say that same thing, Doug.
this is a decrease. None of this is good. This is and so I think there needs to be some perspective. Now, unfortunately, I think a lot of it is more soundbite than anything else, right? Yeah. I think you have, people who, it's easy to pile on. It's easy to pile on to Chicago. But a few things I think that are unique about Chicago. You go somewhere like Houston and the Third Ward is bad or something like that, In Chicago, things change block by block. There's no doubt about it, right? You tear down a housing project, people start to move and disperse off to different places. Things are not consolidated, I think, as far as like gang leaders. You got a bunch of people who are just locked up. I mean, you got to think about it, man. A lot of these cats out here right now, their fathers are like kids like we went to high school with. The folks who went to high school really didn't necessarily pan out as far as going to college or whatever else and just kind of lived on the block. And a lot of that kids in high school, they're gone. They're dead. They're in prison, whatever the case may be, for long years. And these are the kids out here. Not caring, People, I think there's been points that have been made. When you take down the heads of all these gangs, great. Beat yourself, beat the chest and say, we got Larry Hoover or Jeff Ford or whoever else in prison and Supermax. You can't get in contact with them, this, that, and the other. Well, who the hell is running the show for these kids? All they know is what they've heard about, how things used to be, whatnot. And, you got 15, 16-year-olds like, man, I don't answer anybody at all.
We just Peachtree block. That's what we just do. What we do on this one block.
We out here. You know, so I think, you know, that's the problem. And then I think that there is a general mistrust. I mean, a general mistrust into the community and police. Period. I mean, there's a huge amount of mistrust.
But hasn't it always been though in Chicago? I mean,
I think that's always been my understanding. You know, but
yeah, I think it's a time where it was all good.
Yeah, but with that, I think that you end up, you know, I think you end up, you know, closing less cases, you know, and bringing people to, I need the air quotes again here, to justice, right? So, I mean, if people know who killed so-and-so, and the police, and they're not doing anything, or they're not cooperating with the police, I mean, it's more vigilante style, I think, in many regards, which is unfortunate. Then the last thing, this really should be the first thing, quite frankly, I think you go neck and neck. I mean, jobs and damn education and jobs.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the notion of like that all these 15 and 16 and 18 and 20 year olds, like they want to live on the block dodging bullets every day is bullshit. Like, this is actually the thing, and I had this conversation with somebody recently. This is the thing when you get from like issues to politics. Like, we get divisive when we talk about politics, right? But most people actually agree on a few things. Like, I want to live in a safe neighborhood. Most people say that. I mean,
all people would say that. If slanging, they got their family living somewhere else that ain't popping.
Right. So everybody wants to live in a comfortable place. Everybody, for the most part, believes that education is important. Now, how we, you know, how we dole that out, we can argue about, you know, whether it's school vouchers, a charter school, this, that, and the other. But everybody tends to agree that education is important. You know, education is not relevant, first of all, for these kids. I think you have a problem, right? I mean, you got kids that show up to school, man, and they're not an A-ball before they get there. They really are. Like, these are stories about kids, man, who, like, their only meal is at school. I mean, how do you possibly compete? How do you get prepared for the ACT when you eat one damn meal a day? I mean, seriously. So, I mean, I think it's at an institutional level, man, you know, and I don't have the easy answer, but I can tell you that if we don't get these kids some jobs, you know, and really boost the education system, then we're going to keep having these problems. Because
do you think it's the focus on Chicago, though, is because of Barack?
I think the focus on Chicago is because it's easy to focus on Chicago. I really do. I mean, you know, and part of it is because, like, you look at places like New York, where, I mean, like, homicides and violent crimes and things like that really did go down drastically. Right, I mean, kind of the same thing with LA. They had the same thing with police chief, right? We had the same theory, and he went and ran things the same way, you know, in two different places. I mean, the next really large or major city to focus on is Chicago, and I think it's the allure of the, you know, the Al Capone and something like way back.
I was going to ask you that.
Day.
Yeah,
yeah. I think there's just that, like, you know, and it's just, you know, the story just keeps feeding itself.
And it's really a city that shouldn't really be a city if you really look at it. Like, if you just look at it, Chicago's really not on the coast where you have any ports or anything like that. It's literally just a city that popped up and kind of blew up on its own organically.
Yeah, stockyards.
Yeah.
Things like that. I mean, yeah. Absolutely. It absolutely did. So I think the attention on Chicago is unfair. I don't think it's specifically because of Obama, but you got to remember, man, we're talking about soundbite. I mean, doesn't it sound crazy when you say, like, man, this girl, you know, just came from the White House, and then she got killed, like, right by Obama's house. Like, but you've been to my house. I mean, yes, it's not chilly far, but it's a world of difference. Like,
No. We just sat out there at 2 or 3 in the morning just talking, standing there with no worries.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you go down the street, those houses are, you know, 4 times the amount of our houses, right? So, I mean, it's a totally different ballgame. It's not like she was, you know, standing in front of Obama's house at the Secret Service and got shot. Like, I mean, you know, but the soundbite is, oh, young girl shot by Obama's house. Put that Obama in there, and then Chicago, whenever you can tie those two together, then, yeah, you're going to get more ratings.
Yeah. All right, man, let's go into this, your top 5 MCs, man. You know, this is a hip-hop podcast, man, even though we had some serious talk, man. What's your top 5 MCs, man? Yes. You know, it could be right now, it could be all time. It's up to you. You choose.
You know what, man? I'm gonna do a little eclectic mix right now. This person is not an all time at all, but this is my, I'm right now. You're very clear about that. I really like Chance a lot. And I want to be very clear. I'm not putting Chance up there with everybody else. I'm talking about right now. If I'm popping something in the car, if I'm going for a run or whatever, like, I'm going to listen to Chance. Gotta have Rakim. That's just a no-brainer to me. I like Andre 3000. That's a no-brainer to me. Big L, they have a long tenure, but I got to throw Big L in there. That's kind of a no-brainer to me. I'm a Jay-Z guy. You know, so I think that's four or five.
That's five, or there's no Pac?
Actually, I think Pac, wait, hold on. Let me say, I said Big L, I said Jay-Z.
Chance the Rapper.
I did, you know, I'm going to say Chance. I'm going to go ahead and go all the time for Pac up there. Chance has plenty of time to catch up. I can't go top five. I mean, because you said, you know, like all time versus now, like, you know, the hell, man, let me say this. Chance is going to listen to right now along with a couple other folks, whatever. But yeah, Pac has to be in there. Not necessarily for his lyrics, but for the energy that he brought to the game and the real understanding of, like, power structure.
Pac like, was direct with his lyrics.
Exactly.
He didn't hit with no rhyme scheme. It was like, look, this is what I feel like over this beat.
Exactly. But, I mean, I just think, you know, as far as creativity, it's like Andre 3000 is just off the charts, man. Rakim, man. Like, you know, just
the God MC.
Period. Yeah. Period. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, I would be like incredibly humbled to meet that cat. Like, for real, humbled. Like, bro, you're the man, for real, across generations.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If anybody tries to suggest that, like, that Rakim is not the man, like, then it'll be smacked.
Yeah, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it. So, I
could listen to anything else. They had the same. Nothing else.
Like, before I even get into the last question, how do you feel about the whole drill music scene for Chicago? Do you think that affects a lot of the violence as well and, you know, things like that? Because a lot of people try to act like drill music has something to do with it and stuff like that.
Right. I mean, so here's the thing, though. I mean, if that's the case, then, like, you know, in the news music, you know, make somebody, you know, rip their mother, right? Or cut the girl, you know, put a girl in the trunk and drive off a cliff. I mean, right? Has that happened? Has anybody cited Eminem for, you know, like some domestic violence situation?
Yeah.
Like, no. I mean, look, the drill music, man, is an expression. The music is one thing. The culture goes along with it. What's happening in Chicago, if you watch, like, some of these drill music videos and things like that, like, these 14 and 15-year-olds drinking lean and shit, like, they're 15, 20 years behind, number one. Like, to me, that's the real concern. I mean, you see these cats out there, like, they're not just, like, smoking weed, you know, all these other different,
they smoke,
you know,
a shirt.
Substances. they're out there bad. So it's not even the music, man. The music to me is a way to express what's going on. Like, you know, it's easy to look at these kids and blame them and say, well, you know, whatever, but we're not growing up in that environment. Even if you grew up on the same exact block, you grew up on that block 20 years ago. It's different. It's totally different now. So I like the drill music, you know what I'm saying? I really do. I'm 35 years old. I'm about to shoot somebody because I heard songs. I don't think that most. I don't buy. You know, like, I used to listen to N.W.A. I mean, it's everything, but I don't believe that music makes people go out and start shooting people. I don't believe that at all anymore. Than, you know, how many times you see them Terminator?
Yeah.
Like, did you go out and start blasting people? I mean, come on, man. Nah.
All right, this is the hardest section, man. I call it the don't get fucked up section, man, where you got to tell an embarrassing story or where you played yourself, man, you know. So you got to give us a story.
Man, you know what, man? There's plenty of stories to that. But I'll tell you, like, probably one of the worst moments of my life.
Okay.
For real. And this is when I was young, as far as playing myself it goes, right? So we all outside playing around. I live at one of my guys' house. And there's one cat who, he was, like, kind of just intimidating, like, you know, big, swole. I'm like you. You know, we're scrying.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I'm saying? We do the best we can.
We're part of Team Flacco, as I call it. We're Team Flacco.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I'm out there. I'm trying to be cool and stuff like that. I don't have, actually, I'll tell you two quick stories. So, anyway, man, I got nervous, right? I'm like, hey, Willie, man. He's like, yeah. I'm like, man, what's your name? Like, I ain't never talked to somebody, man. So I said the dude's name and asked his name. But the time I was probably most embarrassed in my life was my great aunt had a property in Roseland, and there's a big pile of rocks out there. I found some silver spray paint, and my sister spray painted high on the rocks. Not that bad, not that big of a deal. I went to the alley and spray painted "fuck you."
Oh.
And so she was like, "I'm calling a five," which I knew was like gonna be good. I knew it was gonna be good. So we was actually out in the alley playing ball. And so the crew, like, everybody's out there or whatever. And I got my butt whooped out in the alley in front of everybody. Oh, while I was trying to explain. Yeah, while I was trying to explain that there wasn't an F, it was an E. Like, yeah.
What was the E?
It
was an E, not an F? Like, what did you say?
No, it was an F.
I know, but how would you try to, what word would you try to use then?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like E-U-C-K was a word.
Yeah, like... But yeah, it's some German stuff I learned, you know, Pops, you know. You're trying to get me to learn better. But man, dude, man, thank you for coming on my dude, man.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is dude, man. I know a lot of people will definitely enjoy this and see, like, you know, how, you know, you can switch up the game and constantly always keep yourself innovating and elevating, man. Let everybody know where they can, you know, check out Vice District social media-wise, where, you know, where they can check out our website, all that good stuff.
So the website for the brewery is just www.vicedistrictbrewing.com. And all of our hashtags or all of our handles or whatever are just at vice_district. So
okay.
Real simple, man.
Yeah, so I mean, because you ain't on Instagram or nothing like that, so, you know, that's the only way, you know, people can holler at you.
Hey, man, look, I'm trying to keep a low profile, brother.
Hey, you are. Hey, Jeff still act like he finna run for president one day. I always told him that, man. You always act like you run for president one day, man.
Hey, listen, I'm going to tell you what. I got a damn good shot, it seems like, based on last night. So.
Hey, you got a lot more credentials, man. You're at least worse than the city, you know, at least within the government or whatnot, man. Well, I'm going to tell one embarrassing story about you, man. But it'll be bad, though, all right? So, Operation Snowmelt had happened already, so that we're not going to talk about that. But there was a situation with one of the people from Operation Snowmelt where I ended up... where this individual was basically, like, he was borderline a Nazi. People listening, borderline Nazi kind of dude. And he was like a guy that was... I don't know if in his mind it was like a social experiment at being roommates with black guys. Like, in his mind where he's like, this is kind of cool. And like, he was kind of like a loner too, though. So like back in the days, though, people understand that when I say this is totally a stereotypical thing I'm going to say. But black people don't drink Coors Light for real. So like, he would come in with...
Even though Ice Cube was on the commercials.
Yeah, exactly. This is 15 years ago. Nobody was drinking Coors Light as a black person. So he would come over with the Silver Bullets and be like, hey, man, you know, I just brought some beer and stuff. And everybody like, cool, cool. And then everybody look at the refrigerator like, but it's all Coors Light. He was like, and it was like, he was like getting mad because we didn't accept his Coors Light. But fast forward, though. So Jeff, after the Operation Snowman incident, like, he calls me like, hey, Swiss, man, hey, come downstairs. So I come downstairs. He's like, hey, man, I just saw that dude walking on the other side of campus, though, talking about he was going to kill himself.
That's so messed up.
What
man.
Should we do? And I was like, I don't know. You know, and he was like, that's one of your roommates. What are you supposed to do? I was like, I mean, I guess we could call Department of Public Safety or whatever. Yeah, I mean, what do you want me to do? He was like, I'm just saying, I'm just letting you know that he tried to throw himself in front of a car or something like that, you said. And I don't know
that's
how
right.
you happened to be there. And like, and he was like,
I remember that, man.
Yeah, and I was in, and I never forget. He just came home and he was like, "I gotta move out, man. I can't do this." And I was like, "Cool, you know, because we was living in a higher learning lifestyle, you know, at that time."
Yeah.
Which I tell people all the time, higher learning was definitely my college experience, 100%. But
100%.
Like, I remember I was talking to the wife and everything, and she went to FAM, and she was like, she can't relate to that movie, and I'm like, "Yo, you don't understand, like."
You're the wrong school.
You was, yeah. You related to Stomp the Yard a little bit too much, you know. So
right,
that's exactly. Your experience at Stomp the Yard. So, but and I remember Jeff was just like, just one day people just do dumb stuff like that, man. They do wrong. They put themselves in the wrong state of mind. And he crazy, man. I told you he was crazy. And then you had this long thing about, I told you he was crazy when he first moved in. I told you he was crazy, man. But no, man, that was them times, man, we had then was so dope, man. I wish I could tell so many other stories of people, man, but I can't, man.
Absolutely, man. No, you cannot.
Yeah, because you're trying to run for president one day. Oh, no, you know, not president, but have a decent career, you know, in life.
Right, man. I might be on a school board for my kids or something, man.
Yeah, they go online and be like, Curtis Tarver. What
right,
are you
exactly.
doing? You know, but man, no,
exactly.
man. Thank you for coming on, man. Dude, you may not know it, man, but people look up to you and role model, man.
I appreciate
that's
that.
A, you know, I age too, man. People definitely, if they hear your story, man, people gonna be like, yo, like, I might want to go out and start whatever it is, man. So, man, yeah, man. Thank you, dog. You know, this is big man. Also, man, I forgot people. You know, you're a member of a fraternity and stuff. So, you know, I know you want to, you know, represent on that. You know,
I'm a Q. About that.
Hey, for the record, hold on. I gotta did you listen to the wedding podcast yet, man?
No, I haven't, man.
On there, people they already listen. The listeners had already listened to it, but on there, so one of my podcast partners, my boy Matt, he's a Kappa. So he's on there, and Javon, they on there talking, hosting it. So they go like, yeah, man, I think one of Swiss boys that took his shirt off. And his step.
Hey, man. It got good to me, man.
That's the thing that was hilarious. It was like, they know who you were like that. They were like, I think one of the Swiss boys took his shirt off. That's how crazy this reception is.
Yeah, that was one of the best times of my life, I gotta tell you.
Hey, man, you might end up being on some Q site or something, man, because Jasmine sent it to some other Q or whatever of you and Jerron stepping with your shirt off.
Oh, man. Hey, I'll be in trouble by somebody.
Yeah,
but it was a good time.
That was a good time, man. But you, yo, man, proud of you as always, man. Thank you for coming on, man.
Appreciate you, brother. All right. Absolutely, man.